journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's August 31st, 2007. I'm your host, sitting in for Sonali, Thane Mori, Soundararajan.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
The staggering cost of U.S. business leadership. Manda Bala, the new film and documentary about in Brazil, and Katrina in prisons.
If my eyes drop when the fellow meadows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. According to a new report, CEOs collected as much money from one day on the job as average workers made over the entire year. Authored by the Institute for Policy Studies and United for a Fair Economy, the report, called The Executive Excess 2007, The Staggering Social Cost of U.S. Business Leadership, shows that CEOs at the biggest U.S. companies averaged $10.8 million in pay and associated compensation, based on data from 386 of the Fortune 500 companies. That figure for CEO salaries equates to more than 364 times the pay of the average American worker, with the average American worker's salary coming in at $30,000. Furthermore, through tax dodging, creative accounting, and simply benefiting from favorable tax policies, CEOs are also able to keep more of their salary in their pockets. This Labor Day, as U.S. workers can celebrate the first raise in minimum wage in 10 years, bringing it from $5.15 per hour to $5.85 an hour, that rate in real value is still 7% below the value of the minimum wage in 1996. Another sobering statistic for this Labor Day weekend is the fact that over 15% of workers are without health insurance, a number that is at an all-time high. Joining us to talk about the growing pay gap is study co-author Sarah Anderson, director of the Global Economy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies and lead author of this study. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So can you summarize some of the key findings of this report? Because it is pretty staggering. I think that's an accurate title.
Yeah, well, I think you summed it up pretty well. I mean, the big headline is just that CEOs of large firms made as much in one day as average workers made the entire year. But another thing we did this year is we compared how much corporate CEOs are making to how much leaders in other sectors of our society are making, because we think it's important to have strong leadership throughout society, not just in the corporate world. But instead, what the paychecks of these guys say is that they are valued at hundreds, if not thousands, of times more than other leaders. For example, the corporate CEOs made roughly 200 times as much last year as the top 20 leaders in Congress, in the military, and in the executive branch. They made about 40 times as much as leaders in nonprofits, including university presidents and leaders of major medical research centers. And again, that just, it's a problem because it drains a lot of leadership talent away from these other fields that are so critical to our society's overall health.
And you also compared U.S. business leaders with European business leaders as well. And how big was that gap? Because these are also multinational companies. So I was just curious about that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Americans are still leaving their European counterparts in the dust when it comes to compensation. Last year, the top 20 European highest paid corporate leaders made only about one-third as much as the top 20 U.S. Corporate highest paid leaders, even though the Europeans led companies that were quite substantially larger, had much larger sales than the U.S. firms. Although I would have to say in Europe, those pay levels are also rising, and there's quite a raging debate there. Even the new president of France, who's hardly a wild liberal, he's quite a conservative guy, he campaigned on the promise that he would do something about rising CEO pay in that country, and he's already introduced some legislation on that.
Wow. I was also curious, in terms of, I know that in the report, you cite actually all of the fringe benefits CEOs get, because in addition to their large incomes, there's various tax breaks that people receive. Can you break down for our listeners what actually goes into their kind of plump portfolio?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we have increased reporting on these kinds of things thanks to some changes in the disclosure requirements for companies. So now we get a lot more details in the kind of perks that they're getting, and it's fascinating to see these guys get reimbursed for when they take the corporate jet on their vacation. They get reimbursed for that. They get special health exams for corporate executives since, you know, I guess the message is these human beings are just so much more valuable than anybody else at these companies. They get reimbursed for extra taxes they have to pay when they get massive bonuses. They get help doing their tax forms. They get personal financial assistance. It goes on and on. And that's, of course, on top of the pensions, the cash bonuses, the stock options, the stock grants. It's really quite a wide range of things that they put together in order to entice these men into these jobs based on the belief that they are these superhumans, when, of course, in reality, so many people contribute to the value of these companies.
And going back to the perks, the top 386 CEOs took in perks worth an average of $438,000 in 2006 alone. And, you know, I love the fact that you contrasted that a minimum wage worker would then need to work 36 years to earn the equivalent of what a CEO average in just, you know, perks, you know.
It's really insane. I mean, these are the fringe benefits. These are just the, you know, the icing on the cake, and yet it still adds up to such an absurd sum. And a lot of that tends to be reimbursement for riding on the private company jets. And I find it amusing. They always say in these corporate statements that that is necessary for the security, the personal security of these executives to not fly commercial airlines. I guess they assume that all these guys are going to get kidnapped or something if they, you know, bumped elbows with the rest of us.
I want to remind our listeners, on the phone with us is Sarah Anderson, director of the Global Economy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she is co-author of a new report that is also released with United for a Fair Economy called Executive Excess 2007, The Staggering Social Cost of U.S. Business Leadership. Now, this is the 14th Annual Labor Day Report. What have you seen in terms of the accumulation of the statistics you've done over the years, and where do you feel like this year stands out in that?
Well, it's pretty much par for the course over the past 15 years. 15 years ago is when these pay packages really started exploding. And so just to give you some comparison, back in 1980, for example, the gap between what average CEOs made and average workers was only 42 to 1. This year we found it to be 364 to 1. And so it's been a depressing thing to work on for 14 years. But I have to say this year I feel a bit more hopeful because I feel like we're seeing an unprecedented political debate on what to do about excessive CEO pay. There are several bills in Congress that address it, and we also have two leading presidential candidates in Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama who are frequently denouncing this CEO worker pay gap on the campaign trail.
Can you discuss between Obama and Clinton their different positions about CEO pay, and you know where you kind of stand on you know cutting through what their public position is, and then also the money that they're receiving?
Right. Well, Barack Obama is the lead sponsor in the Senate of a bill that would give shareholders the right to vote every year on executive pay packages. Now, this would be a non-binding vote, but a lot of people think it could have some impact just in embarrassing corporate boards who continue to give out really excessive pay packages to poorly performing CEOs. That's a bill that's already passed the House, and now, as I said, he's championing it in the Senate. And I find that positive, but we do want members of Congress to go further and, for one thing, fix the loopholes that are currently in our tax policies that actually encourage these excessive pay levels. And so, for example, Representative Barbara Lee is about to introduce a bill that would cap the tax deductibility of CEO pay. So companies couldn't deduct from their taxes any amounts that are over 25 times what the lowest paid worker in a company makes. We think those kinds of you know, ways of fixing the tax code so that at least the rest of us aren't subsidizing these sky-high pay levels is really positive. And I don't think either Obama or Hillary Clinton have come down in support of that. Clinton, like I said, has been frequently talking about CEO pay on the campaign trail, but her solutions have mostly been about increasing disclosure and transparency and the independence of boards, and we're hoping that she'll go a bit further.
And I also want to go back to what has been the response to the report, and also what the impacts, like how do you see the impacts of such staggering, you know, inequality?
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, I do think that Congress is much more engaged on this. I've had several calls from people in Congress, even though they are, you know, supposed to be on vacation right now. It's the August recess. But people are really focusing on this issue and trying to come up with solutions. So I feel quite hopeful. Now, from the business world, of course, we get the big backlash every year. And I think they're fighting back harder now, too, because they're worried that moves are afoot to actually do something about this for a long time. And so, you know, I did a debate on CNBC where it was me against four other people who were all on the other side. And, you know, they tend to get hysterical and say that, oh, these people want to put it an absolute ceiling on how much somebody can earn in this country, and that's not American. And nobody in reality is calling for an absolute cap on how much someone can earn. What we're talking about is fixing the tax loopholes that are actually encouraging and subsidizing these high pay levels.
Mm-hmm. That is Sarah Anderson, Director of the Global Economy Program, and she's discussing the new report that the Institute for Policy Studies released with United for a Fair Economy, Executive Excess 2000, the staggering social cost of U.S. business leadership. I want to go back, Sarah, to the question I asked earlier. What has been the response from other organizers, from people in labor, from mm-hmm. just normal American people to both these findings, but also I think there's kind of just a social knowledge that this is happening.
Right.
You know, I mean, reports like this are great because they give you actual mm-hmm. numbers, but we know something very drastically wrong is happening with our pay scale, you know?
Yeah, well, we've seen polls for quite a while now showing high levels of concern among the American public about this. There was one by the Financial Times just a month ago that said 77% of Americans think our corporate executives earn too much money. I think the problem in terms of really mobilizing people and translating that concern into action is people don't feel like there's anything they can really do about it. And so I'm excited that now there are some proposals in Congress that people can get behind, both the bills to give shareholders more of a say on these things and also the efforts to close these tax loopholes. I'm hoping that that might generate more activity. I think another thing is that people, although they might get outraged, they might not connect the dots. Like, why is the fact that these guys at the top making so much money, how does that affect people, poor people and working class people? And I think, again, it's so important for people to understand that as long as these guys are getting away with these huge tax loopholes, that means that the rest of us have to make up for that. That means we're subsidizing these grotesque levels of pay. And also, for unions, they understand that this affects worker morale. When you're getting a pittance compared to what the boss is making, that can affect productivity. And that's something that should concern everybody, not just workers, but the people at the top of these corporations.
And Sarah, I guess the other piece is that, you know, when I'm looking at your key proposals for change, a lot of it is focused on capping the CEO salaries, but I think it's almost two-pronged. Like, we've got to cap salaries and then also continue to raise the minimum wage to a working wage. And I wonder if we could actually turn to that a little bit and talk about the fact that the minimum wage was finally raised from $5.15 to $5.85, but talk about what that actually means in real figures and in real people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big victory, which should be applauded. But the reality is that even at $5.85, in real terms, the minimum wage is still 7% below where it was a decade ago, whereas, by contrast, CEO pay over that same period has increased by about 45%. And so a lot more needs to be done to make sure that people are earning a decent living in this country for all the hard work that they do. And I think we really need to unite these efforts to both, you know, bring down the top of this extreme inequality gap and lift up the bottom. And I'll just raise again this bill that Barbara Lee is about to introduce, which would cap the tax deductibility of executive pay at no more than 25 times what the lowest paid worker makes. We're hoping that that will encourage more reasonable pay levels at the top, but it also gives an incentive to lift up the bottom. So you have a narrower range between what workers and CEOs are making. And, you know, there are some CEOs out there who are already practicing this at Whole Foods. They have a ratio of 19 to 1. That's the biggest gap they can have in pay there. There's another investment fund manager who actually has a 7 to 1 gap in his firm. And so there are some business leaders out there who get it, that it's good for everybody to have smaller pay gaps. But we still have a long way to go, and I don't think we can rely entirely on them figuring it out for themselves and doing it voluntarily.
All right. Well, we will have to leave it right there. Sarah, can you give us the website where people can read the report and actually learn more about how they can get involved?
Absolutely. And I'll say, too, that we are really interested in partnering with groups who want to take on these extreme inequalities. And so feel free to give me a buzz or an email if you're interested in getting involved with that. And our website at the Institute for Policy Studies is www.ips-dc.org, ips-dc.org.
Okay. We've been speaking with Sarah Anderson, Director of the Global Economy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies, lead author of the new study, Executive Excess, The Staggering Social Cost of U.S. Business Leadership. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks so much.
All right. Later in the hour, we will talk with documentary filmmaker Jason Cohn about his new film, Mandala Bala, Steal a Bullet, about corruption and crime in Sao Paulo. But first, this radical day in history with Radio Roots and Peace Vigils for this week.
In the KPFK Film Club's 5th August presentation, Klimt, it is 1918.
People!
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, August 31st, in 1935, U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Neutrality Act of 1935, prohibiting the export of U.S. arms to belligerent countries. While this act intended to prevent America's involvement in foreign conflicts, the ambiguous wording left a lot of room for manipulation. Throughout the rest of his term, President Roosevelt used many of these loopholes to make sure that U.S. allies overseas still received enhancements to their armories.
Well, you know what they say, laws are made to be broken, especially when these laws don't work toward U.S. interests. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
In the KPFK Film Club's 5th August presentation, Klimt, it is 1918, and the famed Austrian artist, played by John Malkovich, lies on his deathbed. Chilean emigre writer-director Raul Ruiz has explored the turn-of-the-century world of excess and decadence before, in Time Regained, the life and work of Marcel Proust. Here he focuses on Klimt's feverish visions back to the World Exhibition of 1900 in Paris. Ahead of his time, Klimt was celebrated in the City of Light, but condemned in his hometown of Vienna for being sexually provocative, as was his contemporary Egon Schiele, here played by Nikolai Kinski, son of the late great Klaus. Also co-starring Veronica Ferres, Stephen Delane, and Saffron Burrows, Klimt opens Friday, August 31st at the landmark New Wilshire in Santa Monica and the Lemley One Colorado in Pasadena, and KPFK Film Club members know how to call the station switchboard for a pass.
It's time now for our weekly Peace Vigil announcements. I'm Gabriel San Roman.
Neighborhood activists all over Southern California hold regular peace vigils to end the war in Iraq. Each week we announce just some of the 50-plus vigils that are taking place. Complete listings of all vigils are available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. On Fridays in Glendale, from 5 to 7 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of Brand Boulevard and Broadway. The information line is 818-662-0412. Again, that's 818-662-0412. On Saturdays in Eagle Rock, from 4 to 6 p.m., there's a peace vigil on the corner of Colorado and Eagle Rock Boulevards. The information line is 323-899-0698. Again, that's 323-899-0698. On Fridays in Long Beach, from 7 to 9 p.m., there's a peace vigil at 2nd and Nieto in Belmont Shore. The information line is 562-866-7743. Again, that's 562-866-7743. On Thursdays in Westwood, there's a peace vigil from 5 to 7 p.m. at Wilshire and Veteran Boulevards in front of the Westwood Federal Building. The information line is 310-447-8997. Again, that's 310-447-8997. On Fridays in Studio City, there's a peace vigil from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on the corner of Laurel Canyon and Ventura Boulevard. The email contact is neighborsteve2002@yahoo.com. That's neighborsteve2002@yahoo.com. On Fridays in Claremont, there's a peace vigil from 4:30 to 6 p.m. on the corner of Indian Hill Boulevard and Arrow Highway. The information line is 909-399-3451 or 909-621-5811. And finally, on the first Sunday of each month in Woodland Hills, there's a peace vigil from 5 to 6 p.m. on the corner of Topanga and Oxnard Boulevards. The email contact is renelancon@aol.com. That's renelancon@aol.com. A complete list of vigils is available at www.neighborsforpeaceandjustice.org or www.peacevigils.com. Special thanks to Jennifer Hiller.
Good morning and welcome back to Uprising. Manda Bala is a new documentary about corruption in Brazil. Going beyond Brazil's sun-drenched beaches, this documentary explores the connections between government corruption and the kidnapping industry in Sao Paulo. Through stunning imagery, the doc weaves the interviews of kidnapped victims, kidnappers, frog farmers, plastic surgeons, police, and even the corrupt politician Jader Barbalho. Barbalho was accused of siphoning millions of dollars for his own use from Sudam, a development program to help the poor in Brazil's Amazon region, into a complex portrait of crime in Sao Paulo. Manda Bala was recently named Best Documentary in Sundance. Joining us in studio to discuss his film is filmmaker Jason Cohn. Welcome, Jason.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
So tell us, can you share with our listeners, what was the journey you took to make this film? Because I know there were several challenges involved.
Well, it was really fairly an organic process. You know, I was living in Boston and kind of wanted to get out of there and wanted to make my own movie. And I had the opportunity to do that either in the United States under very, very constrained conditions, financially mainly, or go to Brazil, where the exchange rate was a little bit more lenient for an independent filmmaker. And so, you know, I sold my car, went down to Brazil after doing lots of research and finding these two stories that I thought were absolutely fascinating. One about a frog farm that was at the center of this $2 billion political corruption scandal, which immediately elicited the question, well, what is a frog farm and why is it there? And the other about a plastic surgeon who reconstructs the ears of people get kidnapped, get their ears cut off during the process of being kidnapped. So these two very unique Brazilian industries, namely frog farming and plastic surgery, that kind of started this project about kidnapping and corruption, or the ways that the very rich and powerful steal from the poor and impoverished and disenfranchised, and the way that the poor, impoverished, and disenfranchised steal back from the very rich and powerful.
And in talking about the documentary coming together organically, did you start the interviews and then the interviews actually came together, or did you actually want to make the analysis between the systemic problems you saw with government corruption and the kidnapping industry?
Well, it started off as being way more it was going to be a lot more metaphorical. It was, you know, I was going to a frog farm, and it was going to be about imagery, and there's going to be a crime in the background, but it wasn't going to be touched on in detail. I didn't know what I was doing is the truth, and, you know, I didn't have the clearest idea. You know, I was fascinated by this frog farm, but I had no idea that the actual owner of this frog farm, the largest in the world, actually, was tied to the corrupt politician, Jader Barbalho. I had no idea, and then, you know, in the interview, that's when it came out, and all of a sudden, we realized that we had actually stumbled upon something, that this trail of money laundering could have very well possibly been, you know, going through this frog farm. With the other side of the story, the kidnapping side, those characters started started assembling while we were in production, and actually pre-production. So, for instance, you know, while kind of looking into the kidnapping culture, so to speak, in Sao Paulo, we discovered a course on how to drive your bulletproof car and avoid getting kidnapped. Well, I mean, that's crazy. And it was definitely worthy of being in this documentary because it was just fascinating, and we were able to shoot it like a car chase sequence, because literally you get in a car, your bulletproof car, and you get chased by another car, and they shoot paintball guns at you, and they, you know, you're
practicing
to spin out.
For being kidnapped.
Yeah. So, I mean, it kind of happened like that. It was one thing led to another, which led to another, but there was an idea that in the background, always from the beginning, that it was about this kind of invisible class war going on in one of the most unfair and unjust societies in the world.
And in some ways, I think that it's kind of the way we're reduced in terms of a media cycle of understanding structural issues in our own country. We never really see the media make connections. We just kind of experience these really disparate, really strange things. So it becomes very normal to know that a politician is farming money through a frog farm. You have people getting kidnapped and having their body parts sent through their families, and you have the poor not receiving money, but no one's connecting the lines, you know?
Well, I think the major point of the movie is that, you know, it's to restructure the idea of what political corruption means. A lot of people would just assume that it's an act of theft. Well, that doesn't really make a lot of sense when you're stealing money from the poorest people in the entire world. I mean, especially in developing countries, political corruption is not just theft. I mean, these people have the responsibility to act in accordance to their societies and their, you know, legislature and their citizens. And when that trust is breached, you know, you're talking about an act of political violence. You know, corruption, political corruption is a violent crime, and that's actually the real point of the movie. You're not going to get that point when you look for a dry journalistic approach to something like a political corruption scandal, because what is a political corruption scandal? I mean, corruption is really hard to film. It's what happens between, you know, white men in the backs of office buildings. I mean, you can't, you know, get at that, but what it means and its actual large-scale social ramifications is something very, very real that affects millions and millions of people. I think you're right. I mean, you know, it's not that I think that it's necessarily the responsibility of the media to create these links, but we stumbled upon, I think, a very strong link, and that being, you know, you can't steal $2 billion from the most impoverished people in the world without horrible social ramifications occurring.
I mean, you know, as someone who's been a media justice organizer, I do feel that in a democracy, the media is one of the ways that you have public forum around these issues, right? But I was going to actually go back to something you had said earlier, which I think is really difficult, because I think both in the U.S. and in Brazil, you have a very complex race system. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk to you about how you navigated your own privilege coming from the United States to talk about what was also a very racialized, you know, problem of poverty and corruption, and how you navigated that and what were some of the challenges with that.
Well, from the beginning, I didn't want this to be a movie about poverty. I wanted this to be about wealth, decadence, and corruption. I wanted it to be about the conditions under which poverty proliferates and the people who benefit from gross economic disequilibrium. I also think it's fairly condescending often when, you know, liberal white, you know, Westerners go down to third world countries and stick cameras in the faces of essentially people who don't have the education to even say, hey, I don't want that camera in front of me, or where's my release? You know, that, and it happens every single day. And I think a lot of important movies have come out of that kind of thing. But I didn't want this to be like that. It's a lot harder to interview the people who benefit from gross economic disequilibrium than the people who suffer from it. And And I thought it was an important perspective because you don't – I mean, these problems are universal, right? I mean, every single developing country and most developed countries as well deal with various forms of political corruption and street violence. But in the end, we needed a character that represented that story. So what we did is – and we had this kidnapper character who was really kind of a typical in his family life. His father's coming from north down to the south. That migratory pattern being a kind of a part of the movie and explaining how these oligarchs in the north create such enormous poverty that the only ways, you know, for these people to survive is to go down to Sao Paulo or sometimes Rio as well for a small piece of the pie.
Well, and it's very interesting because I think that, you know, when I was looking at some of the criticism of the film and just really trying to get a background to prepare for this segment, you have a lot of people who really liked the film but felt like you didn't make all the connections. And I think there's always going to be critics of a film. But I wonder, with the kidnapper character, I wonder if showing some of the structural problems he was talking about would have helped with that. What's your response to that?
I mean, that's I find that funny because, you know, also another thing about contemporary documentary that I wasn't so into was the conceit that documentary form is the ultimate substance over style, that, you know, style, you know, documentaries are a separate form of storytelling and not a genre within cinema. And that was something I wholeheartedly, you know, wholesale threw out the window starting off. You know, I thought this was going to be, you know, substance and style married the same way that all movies are. I personally filmed the things that I thought were absolutely fascinating. Now, you know, I went into a surgery room and filmed the ear reconstruction because I thought that that was one of the most amazing things I'd ever seen. You know, I think that there's just as much substance in there because you're actually learning how an ear is reconstructed from somebody's rib as there is style because we shot it in a highly stylized way. It's weird because this movie was so much one of the great inspirations was a movie, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, which is not a movie for everybody, but one of my favorite movies I've ever seen. And a lot of people don't see the connection in that film as well. It's about a mole rat specialist and a robot scientist, you know, all these very, very disparate elements. But for those who do connect the dots, I think it's one of the most rewarding movies of all time, one of the most original pieces of work, and one of the most important films, at least in my life, and I would argue, ever made. Now, I would also argue that whoever wants to engage in Malandabala in an active participatory way would never in a million years lack any substance. But like Fast Cheap, I think it kind of does require the audience to engage a little slightly more. We're not spoon-feeding these messages.
No, the audience definitely has to engage.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's really interesting because I think that audiences are much more demanding about documentary because of the vacuum of news about the information. So Americans are probably being introduced for the first time to corruption in Sao Paulo through your documentary. So I think there's a hunger. Like, what's that about? Where's it going?
Yeah.
Da, da, da. Well, our American structure for narrative is very simple. It's like, you know, the dramatic arc, ABC, boom.
you know, there are expectations that documentaries are another form of journalism, that are, you know, it's outside of movies, that, you know, you're expected to deliver information in a kind of dispassionate, objective way. And that's another conceit that I just don't think is fairly right. You know, I think a documentary filmmaker has the responsibility to never alter the facts. I mean, to portray a civilization or society or a person as true to the person as you know, as true to their story as possible. Now, not altering the facts aside, that's the right and the responsibility. That's the responsibility of every nonfiction filmmaker. Whereas in fiction filmmaking, you don't really have that. But that's the biggest difference.
Well, but even within that, I mean, I think that there's a very thin line between fact and interpretation and perspective.
Perspective is the thing that every single movie has in common, in that it's every single movie is a unique perspective, and that's I think what should at least delineate documentary from journalism. You know, which I don't think, you know, and especially this is something that's new that's happening in the documentary field, which is super, super interesting. At least to a nerdy kind of doc guy, you know, or somebody who loves movies, you know, the market for theatrical documentaries is so new that a lot of people are just now figuring out what the difference is between a theatrical documentary and a television documentary. You know, when you watch a Frontline or any number of the wonderful programs that, you know, docs at PBS has, you expect a certain journalistic standard that you don't expect necessarily from a theatrical documentary. I think a lot of these lines are being drawn right now because the market for this is so new.
And based on the venue of distribution.
Absolutely.
Right. I want to actually take this moment to re-ID our guest. Joining us in studio is filmmaker Jason Cohn. He is director of the new Sundance awarded documentary, Mandabala. So, Jason, I want to actually go back to the film because I think that, you know, we've talked so much about the aesthetic of the film that I actually want you to talk a little bit about it. To me, one of the things that was so stunning was the photography. And you made some very specific choices, like shooting on film. And I want you to talk about your relationship with your DP, your director of photography, and just what was that collaboration like?
Well, you know, when you start off with this idea that you're going to shoot on film, a billion choices change. I mean, it's you know, a lot of people, you know, I talk to a lot of people about when people want to make movies. And, you know, it's like the first thing that I say is you got to figure out what you want to make it for. If you want to make it on video with the conventions of television, you should make it for television. If you want to make it for theatrical, it's going to be a lot harder, a lot more expensive, and satisfying in a certain way. But you know, if that's what you really want to do, you got to really dig in your heels in that direction. So from the beginning, I wanted it to be a theatrical experience. I wanted it to be in a movie theater, although this, I mean, there are no expectations that it would be, but it was made for that. And so I knew that it needed to be shot on film, and I wanted to shoot in CinemaScope, the way that I think a lot of the movies that I was referencing were shot, because I think a lot of the aesthetics had to do with science fiction films and action films.
And that's why it has that very retro-futuristic look to it.
Well, I always thought that this was a nonfiction RoboCop. I mean, I thought we were showing a futuristic, dystopic society, specifically in Sao Paulo, that a lot of people had no idea about, and the best way to do that was to show it in the visual language of something that was familiar, that those movies like Brazil or Blade Runner or RoboCop, but portraying a very, very real city.
That was Jason Cohn, director of the new film Mandabala, Send a Bullet. This Sundance awarded documentary will be playing tonight at the Lemley Royal Theater in West Los Angeles and Lemley Playhouse 7 in Pasadena. Jason will be at the 7:30 screening at West Los Angeles at 1523 Santa Monica Boulevard. For more information, call 310-477-5581 or visit the website www.mandabala.com. Up next, Black Agenda Radio Report and Katrina in Prisons. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is on Alberto Gonzalez.
Alberto Gonzalez resigned as Attorney General of the United States this week, a body blow to Latino pride. But the Hispanic press, which is much more vibrant and active than the black press, took the occasion in stride and with great dignity. As reported by the excellent website Richard Prince's Journalisms, the Latino press resisted the reflexive urge to circle the wagons around one of their own and accepted the fact that Alberto Gonzalez is George Bush's boy, who worked against their interests and should not be defended. Contrast that with the usual reaction from what's left of black media when an African-American politician of dubious repute and no loyalty to his own people gets attacked by racists. Case in point, former Memphis Congressman Harold Ford Jr. In the last days of his losing campaign for the U.S. Senate, the Republican opposition bought ads on statewide television showing white girls acting like girls gone wild over Harold Ford. It was a racist attack, certainly. Predictably, black folks circled the wagons around the undeserving Harold Ford, Jr., and in doing so, we debased ourselves, defending a man who never defended us. Harold Ford was the worst black congressman to ever hold office. He professed openly that he loved George Bush. Ford ran around the country during Bush's campaign to kill Social Security, hugging and kissing Republicans and pledging to bring down the only social safety net that still exists in the United States. Harold Ford was one of only four black congresspersons to vote in favor of Bush's war powers in 2002. He initiated the rightward tilt that has crippled the Congressional Black Caucus, which can no longer claim to be the conscience of the Congress. Harold Ford Jr. now is in a holding pattern as head of the Democratic Leadership Council, the right-wing bagman for corporate money in the Democratic Party, an organization that was created for the specific purpose of diminishing black and union power in the Democratic Party. In other words, Harold Ford is the enemy. Alberto Gonzalez is the enemy as well. He was the key player in the theft of the 2004 election, which required the disenfranchisement of Hispanic and black voters in many states. He betrayed his own people, Latinos, and the American people. He is a criminal, not a source of pride, but a fountain of shame. The Latino media were mature enough to understand their communal interests, that traitors with a Spanish surname are even more dangerous than Anglos on a racist mission. It appears that black media are anchored back in the Jim Crow days, when we marshaled all of our energies to defend every rascal politician that came up from our ranks. After so many generations, this has become a reflex reaction, but is not politically healthy. Barack Obama calls for 100,000 more U.S. soldiers and Marines, a black man boosting the imperial project. Are we supposed to support him? So what if White Girls Gone Wild ads appear, featuring pale and lascivious women wanting to get into Obama's pants? Do we allow racist attacks to dictate our politics? Have we gone stupid? For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
For more Black Agenda Radio, visit www.blackagendareport.com. Welcome back to Uprising. On the second anniversary of Katrina, a 43-year-old inmate became the fourth person to die in Louisiana's Orleans Parish Prison this year. Prison officials claim the man died of an apparent suicide committed in a 10-person cell through an autopsy that has yet to be performed. Orleans Parish Prison, which was the eighth largest city jail in the nation pre-Katrina, has yet to regain accreditation, lost in the wake of the storm. 2 years ago, hundreds of inmates were abandoned in the facility as the flood waters rose. Now, inmates continue to complain of poor conditions, such as overcrowded 10-person cells, among other problems. High incarceration rates continue to affect the impoverished due to state laws that allow for people to be locked up if they are unable to post bail. Residents of New Orleans have organized against the crisis of the city's criminal justice system. Safe streets and strong communities is an example of community members and activists coming together to address injustices in the system. The organization has pushed for independent police oversight and has sought the downsizing of Orleans Parish Prison. Rosetta James, a member of Safe Street Strong Communities, lost her 29-year-old son in Orleans Parish Prison after he died prior to his day in court. Prison officials told James that her young son's death was due to natural causes. Joining us to talk about the criminal injustice system in New Orleans in the 2 years since the Katrina disaster is Rosanna Cruz, co-director of Safe Street Strong Communities, and Robin Templeton, author of the article Locked Up in New Orleans, which is published in the most recent edition of The Nation. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Rosanna, can I talk with you first? What are we dealing with when we look at what's wrong with the prison system in New Orleans? I mean, there's the facts and then there's the stories, and you guys are really on the ground. So can you share some of that with us?
Absolutely. When we talk about what's going wrong with the prison system, we have to recognize, in terms of what prisons are designed for and their history, which I think Robin did an excellent job in outlining specifically the history of Orleans Parish Prison. As far as they're concerned, nothing's going wrong. The prison's doing exactly what it's supposed to do, which is, you know, in our opinion, it's just kind of a tool in building patronage power for different political machines and for different political actors in the city. there is an extensive prison labor project that the sheriff basically uses to dole out cheap labor to different agencies and businesses in the city. And so what we're seeing is, and certainly the principle is, you know, if you build it, you will fill it. And so as, you know, prisons across the nation, the prison industry is a growth industry. And so we know that in terms of what the prison industrial complex is designed for, it's certainly accomplishing its own goals in terms of keeping people in a system where the folks come in, and particularly in New Orleans, the specifics are really telling, right? Because people get arrested. Let's say that I get arrested today on even a minor municipal charge, a misdemeanor. I get arrested. I go to OPP. It's supposed to be a city jail, but it's, you know, before the storm, it was the largest city jail in the country. And, you know, the scale of it is just really disproportionate in terms of what a city jail is supposed to accomplish. So I get locked up today. The police report may not go to the DA's office for weeks, and then the DA has 45 days for a misdemeanor, 60 days, and even longer if it's a capital offense, right? So then that gets transferred. But those are the days that I spend sitting in jail waiting for the DA's office to decide to take the charges or not. And so in that time, I lose my job, I lose my housing in certain instances, and in many cases, come the 45th day, because the system has been so dismantled or disorganized since the storm, I can sit longer if the proper avenues aren't functioning for that paperwork to go through and for me to get what's called 701 out. And so we have people basically serving time before they're even tried, right? So you get an arraignment, but beyond that, you just sit. And so in that process, people lose any kind of economic stability that they had. And we know through policing that, and through our membership, that it's the poorer communities that are targeted. So we're talking about already vulnerable populations.
That was Rosanna Cruz, co-director of Safe Streets, Strong Communities. I want to turn now to Robin Templeton, author of the article Locked Up in New Orleans, which has just been published in the most recent edition of The Nation. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you.
Robin, I think in looking at your article, you did an excellent job of breaking down the history of Orleans Parish Prison, and I was wondering if you could bring some of that history and connect it to the way that the crisis in crime is really also part and parcel of a wider social crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rosanna's analysis is very important in terms of, you know, your listeners are in L.A., I'm here in New York. Prisons have a certain job to play in our society, given racism and the class stratification that we have. And because the economy was so torn apart and decimated in New Orleans, and because prisons are a growth industry everywhere, you have a situation where the jail and the law enforcement system got back together and has been refunded at a scale that makes every other social service look even more paltry than it already is. So you have the police force and the jail funded back to pre-Katrina capacity when you have one-third of the child care centers. So in terms of what crime problem there is, you have young people coming back to a city often without their families because they have no housing, without schools and job opportunities. And then any crime problem that exists, which is real in New Orleans, is used as a further justification for this massive acceleration of funding for the jail. In terms of its history, the jail, the Orleans Parish Prison, is actually, you know, the county jail. In terms of its size, you all talked about that. I mean, it would be the equivalent of having about 250,000 people locked up in Midtown Manhattan. That's the scale that we're talking about. The numbers would be even bigger in L.A., and it's right in the middle of the city. Back in the day when New Orleans was a colony, it was ruled by the French, the jail was called the workhouse. And if you look at archives that were written in French, and then they're translated, you see that folks who were of African descent who claimed to be free, in other words, it was right before the Civil War, right? And folks who were of African descent, if they were not still living on a plantation, New Orleans was an urban area, they would be arrested, put in the workhouse, and their description translated from the French was so-called free. So folks who were in the jail would then be doled out to perform labor. And so in the wake of the Civil War, when you have a decimated city, slavery is illegal. Black code laws were enforced. And so being on the street, being without a job, the equivalent of the nonviolent offenses that folks are being arrested for in New Orleans today, folks were locked up, brought to the jail, and then used as a workforce. And those folks of African descent that were then free literally rebuilt the city during its first reconstruction. So the labor force that Rosanna was referring to in the jail now is technically voluntary, but if you then look at the conditions inside the jail, getting out to get fresh air, it is a luxury. So who wouldn't want to volunteer?
And, you know, I think one of the sad facts of the prison industrial complex is that with the 14th Amendment removing slavery, the only way that slavery is still allowed is in the prison system. And that's one of the most incredible things that we see, like, as the prison systems expand, you know. But Rosanna, I wanted to actually go back to you, because Safe Streets has really been one of the first responders to help people who are caught up within the prison system. And in reading the article, I was just shocked about, you know, there's so many stories that are shocking, and you think that there's a point where you can't be shocked anymore, but you know, they're just, it's just incredible. And what stood out for me was the woman who had actually called about a 9/11 domestic violence incident, and instead of the police coming to help her, ended up arresting her on an outstanding traffic violation. So when you're dealing with these cases and with people who are struggling, what are things that you're able to do to help fill the gap?
Absolutely. Well, I think that the important thing is that we're talking about stories that are devastating, right? And this week we've been in the process of, you know, commemorating the flood and testifying in this International Human Rights Tribunal about the stories that happen. And one of the important points is that our members, as they go up to testify as witnesses, you know, in this kind of process to bring the U.S. government to the International Criminal Court, they claim and they recognize that this is one of many stories behind it, right? So it's just recognizing the collective nature of this experience, and that there's a pattern of disproportionate death and injury to low-income communities of color, especially black communities, but we're seeing now with the rise of the Latino population here also an increase in the criminalization of Latinos and particularly immigrant workers. And so what Safe Streets has been doing, and I mean that's the other half of our name, right, is strong communities. The antidote to this devastation, the antidote to these horrible stories that we hear and the pain, I mean, you know, Rosetta James is one of our members. We had four members yesterday who personally testified about their experiences of loss and death at the hands of the state. All of these folks have come together, and through building relationships together and through organizing and reaching out to other community members, educating community members about their rights, doing advocacy on the ground. I mean, you know, in some cases, you know, I got a call last night. Somebody's loved one had been arrested. It had happened a couple of hours ago, and they still couldn't figure out where he had been taken. You know, so just being able to share information with folks who are looking for their loved ones, and this is something that we train our members to do in our advocacy training. They can go into the system. They can help find folks. They can advocate for folks to make sure that they get their court dates, which is a really big problem here.
It's all right. We're going to have to leave it right there. Thank you both for joining us. For Uprising Subversive Thought for the Day, I would like to quote Eugene Debs: while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. And while there is a soul in prison, I am not free. That is Eugene Debs. You have been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Ramon is our producer, and Tamika Zogi is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website. Uprising's website can be found via kpfk.org. Just click on Programs in the left column, scroll all the way down until you find Uprising's website. CDs of the show are available www.pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Thane Mori, Sound Adarajan, and thanks for listening.